Welcome to the Making Waves Show, independent voices for peace and justice. This week, we're focusing on the ongoing war in Iraq and Americans' reaction to the U.S. election. As usual, we'll start off with some news from alternative sources. Then Tom Jackson spoke over the phone with Dennis Halliday and then Kathy Kelly. And in the second half, we'll have some announcements of upcoming events and a recorded community forum put on by Seacoast Peace Response and Seacoast Alliance for Democracy that happened earlier this week at the UU Church in Portsmouth. And, of course, some political music, so stay tuned. Foster's Daily Democrat reports that Dover High School has started its first junior ROTC program this year. Commander Matt Sturges is taking charge of the new program. He said, quote, "I'm hopeful it will be successful for some of our kids who can benefit from a structured program that focuses on leadership and citizenship." He added, "It's to give them, the students, the opportunity to be a leader in front of their peers." Dover High School has held several meetings over recent years to get community input on the matter of having a ROTC program at Dover High School, with contentious debate about the subject. Parents, members of the community, and veterans spoke questioning the moral example set by the military and whether they truly taught good citizenship, some suggesting that the program was perhaps a recruitment tool for the U.S. military. In other news, Congressman John Conyers of the House Judiciary Committee wrote an open letter along with other members of Congress asking Ohio Secretary of State Ken Blackwell to respond to reports of election irregularities in the state of Ohio. Their open letter stated, "Collectively, we are concerned that these complaints constitute a troubled portrait of a 1-2 punch that may well have altered and suppressed votes, particularly minority and Democratic votes. First, it appears there were substantial irregularities in vote tallies. It is unclear whether these apparent errors were the result of machine malfunctions or fraud. Second, it appears that a series of actions of government and non-government officials may have worked to frustrate minority voters. Consistent and widespread reports indicate a lack of voting machines in urban, minority, and Democratic areas, and a surplus of such machines in Republican, white, and rural areas. As a result, minority voters were discouraged from voting by lines that were in excess of 8 hours long. Many of these voters were also apparently victims of a campaign of deception, where flyers and calls would direct them to the wrong polling place. Once at that polling place, after waiting for hours in line, many of these voters were provided provisional ballots after learning that they were at the wrong location. These ballots were not counted in many jurisdictions because of a directive issued by some election officials, such as yourself. We're sure you agree with us that regardless of the outcome of the election, it is imperative that we examine any and all factors that may have led to voting irregularities and any failure of votes to be properly counted." Among other questions, the members asked Blackwell to respond to the following. "Why did Warren County officials exclude members of the press from observing vote counting on election night, claiming an FBI agent had warned of a terrorist threat that was a 10 on a scale of 1 to 10, but the FBI has no knowledge of such a warning? Why did precincts in Perry County apparently record more votes than voters? Why did Butler County and a number of other counties record more votes for an underfunded Democratic candidate for state Supreme Court than were recorded for the Democratic presidential candidate? Why did historically Democratic precincts in Cleveland record up to 22 times more votes for the Constitution Party presidential candidate than all third-party candidates combined received in the 2000 election? Why did voters in Mahong County report that when they attempted to record a vote for John Kerry, their votes were displayed as being cast for George W. Bush? Why did there appear to be a shortage of voting machines in traditionally Democratic precincts on election day, causing up to 10-hour delays for voters, while there was an apparent surplus of voting machines in traditionally Republican precincts?" As reported in Al Jazeera, New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights is charging the U.S. with war crimes in Iraq. Ottawa IMC reports that thousands of people, between 8 and 15,000, converged on Ottawa in front of City Hall to hold an anti-Bush rally. Following the march, the People's Global Action Bloc led a group of over 1,000 demonstrators to the Hotel Chateau Laurier, where President Bush is staying while in Ottawa. Demonstrators successfully smashed through several layers of barricades before being met by a large group of masked riot police. Indie Media reports that 5 arrests occurred at this action and 1 injury to a police officer. From the Red Cross website, icrc.org, the International Committee of the Red Cross has been regularly visiting the U.S. detention facility at Guantanamo Bay since early 2002 for the purpose of monitoring that persons held there are treated in accordance with applicable international laws and standards. The ICRC remains concerned that significant problems regarding conditions and treatment at Guantanamo Bay have not been adequately addressed, despite the recent creation of the Office of Detainee Affairs in the U.S. Department of Defense. As reported in The Guardian, Washington funds false sex lessons. A congressional analysis of more than a dozen federally funded, quote, abstinence-only programs unveils a litany of false, misleading, and distorted information in teaching materials after reviewing curriculums designed to prevent teenage pregnancy and sexually transmitted disease. Next, we're going to hear a song by Greg Brown called Homeland.
Back and a good dream to stand up for. I got my hand over my heart, ooh, but I don't feel at home here anymore. Big, big mall in the shake, rattle, and roll at the core. Things sprawl after the fall. Oh, and I don't. Turn of truth and Chief Joseph before. Any quiet words of wisdom drowned out by TV. Train on the track, many, many a heart is sore. We want our country back.
Today on Making Waves, we'll be talking with Dennis Halliday and Kathy Kelly. Dennis Halliday is a former Assistant Secretary General to the UN and led the Iraq program, which included the Oil for Food program, from the Baghdad office until 1998, when he resigned in protest of the economic sanctions. The sanctions, he said, were designed to fail and that they constituted genocide.
Recently in the news here in the United States, there's been a lot of talk about the so-called Oil for Food program scandal. And I was wondering, from your perspective, what is your perspective on this so-called scandal?
Yeah, I think we've got to... look at the realities of the situation and recognize that Oil for Food was introduced in the mid-90s to respond to a humanitarian catastrophe unfolding in Iraq. That was massive malnutrition, not famine, not starvation, but getting very close due to inadequate imports and availability of calories and other intake for the population, particularly children. The program, despite all the bad press and the reference to scandal, fed over 20 million Iraqis from 1997 through 2002 with great success. And this great success is due to the skills of the technocrats working in the Baghdad government, combined with the international bidding process and the delivery and distribution systems which the government ran in the south and center of the country, overseen by the United Nations, and which we, through the World Food Program, ran in the Kurdish north of the country. So in many respects, this was a success in preventing starvation, famine conditions. However, I, of course, have been critical for the constraints imposed upon those of us who ran this program together with the government. We were not able to address some of the fundamental issues, which were the rebuilding of electric power production, water treatment and distribution, and sewage systems. These systems had been destroyed by American bombing in the Gulf War, and water systems and the failure to access potable water was the cause of the high mortality rates amongst children under 5 years that, you know, we reported from the mid-90s right through to the very end and the beginning of the Bush invasion. That was a constraint which made life extremely difficult. Furthermore, the balanced diet was not there. We did not have the animal proteins, the minerals, the vitamins that we all need for good health. Secondly, the exaggeration of abuse, I think, has been extraordinary. We're now hearing that something like $21 billion has been skimmed off the top, so to speak. Well, this is, of course, absolute nonsense. What has happened since 1991, there has been smuggling, or there was smuggling, I should say, out of Iraq into Turkey, and to a lesser extent into Jordan and Syria, and possibly into the Gulf and Iran in the south. The smuggling into Turkey and Jordan was fully approved, fully known by Washington. This was established with the agreement of Washington so that Turkey could have some compensation for the impact of sanctions on Iraq on its own economy, because the border was closed, trade was closed, tourism was closed, and the Turks claimed it was costing them something like $30 billion over this period. Thus, the access to cheap gasoline from Baghdad and the importation of foodstuffs and oils in return was a huge industry, which was run by Baghdad to some benefit of the Kurds in addition. So there's no scandal here. This was a policy decision by Washington, well known, monitored by U.S. satellites, likewise with Jordan, and likewise, as I said, to a lesser extent with Syria. The Iranian scheme and the use of the Gulf was illegal. It was monitored tightly. It was stopped, I believe, on many occasions by an international force. The third point I want to make is that within the program itself, there was oil sales totaling $64 billion. One of the scandals is that the United Nations took 35% of that gross and used it to compensate Kuwait and pay for its own overheads. 30% went to Kuwait. At the same time, as children were dying in Iraq, and we were not allowed to fix their electric power systems, their water treatment and distribution systems. That, to me, is a scandal. In fact, it's a crime. The other problem was that the international bidding process in the late 90s and 2000 and 2001 became slack. The Iraqis, faced with sanctions, which is a form of warfare, wanted to fight back. The way they could do that was to compensate their friends around the world by buying their produce through national corporations or corporations in those particular countries. Others, they simply taxed, so to speak, by a kickback system when the contracts were agreed upon and approved, let me repeat, and approved by the member states of the United Nations sitting in New York. Every contract was approved by the United States and London, for example. In terms of oil sales, which is the other source of income, during the latter part of the program, 1999, perhaps 2000, 2001, Iraq, which was forced to sell its oil cheaply on the market, continued that process and in turn demanded, I don't know, 10, 20, 50 cents per barrel be placed in an account outside the country. This was done knowingly by the oil companies. When Chevron, when Halliburton and others in the United States bought Iraqi oil indirectly, they also paid the kickback. This also was well known to those in Washington who are well informed. So I don't find a scandal here per se. I see a retaliation by Iraq, I see a fight back to the impact of sanctions, and I know this was well known to all of those concerned in the two states that drove the sanctions regime for such a long time, that is the United States and Britain.
This may seem fairly obvious to people who have had a close eye on this issue for quite some time, but for those who have not, what is it that compels, or in your opinion, would compel officials in the United States to turn this into a so-called scandal?
I think there is the motive here, and the motive would seem to be retaliation by some in Washington vis-a-vis the United Nations, because the Security Council and the three permanent members, Russia, China, and France, refused to support the initiative of Mr. Bush to go to war, to invade Iraq, for reasons that are somewhat murky, but would seem to be a mix of removing Saddam Hussein, taking control over a very important and strategic country in the Middle East, and thirdly, and I think most importantly, taking control of the second largest oil reserve in the world, which is of great importance to the United States itself and to the allies of the United States, Japan, China, and Europe.
One of the current reasons that the Bush administration and people who are in favor of a continued occupation of Iraq by the United States, one of the reasons that they say that's necessary is because if we left Iraq now, the country would just, you know, explode into civil war. What's your opinion about that? Do you think that's accurate, or is it like with Vietnam, that same excuse was used for a good 5 years up until the end of that war, and then lo and behold, when we finally pulled out of Vietnam, there was no civil war? You know Iraq quite well, obviously, from having lived and worked there for an extended period of time. What's your opinion about that?
Well, frankly, given what I see on the evening news, I don't think things could get any worse in Iraq, in the sense we already have a civil war, because those who are totally opposed to the American occupation are already killing the collaborators, the Iraqi collaborators, with the occupation, which is a sad but traditional, I suppose, mix when you have a foreign power, a military force in a sovereign country. I believe that the occupation should be terminated immediately. I don't think these coming elections are going to be legitimate under occupation. I think those who really want to get involved, many will not feel free to do so under the eye of American forces nabbing up to 150,000. I think the Iraqis are sophisticated people. They're familiar with elections. They've had a National Assembly for 30 years. They know how to make it work. I think they will have difficulties, but I sense that the Kurds, which is an ethnic and an ethnic minority, they're mainly Sunni. I think the Kurds, the Sunni population of the center, and the Shia majority of the south, they know the price of failure. They will not want civil war. They've seen the pain of the last 30 years of various wars, external and internal, and they will go for something, I think, something more compromise. Of course, the Shia majority are going to want power. They're going to want to be a majority party in the National Assembly. Why would we expect otherwise? Will they give us the sort of democracy that this country enjoys? Probably not. Will they give us something that may be workable and acceptable to Iraq? I think they probably will. Iraq has never had a democratic system. They've been used to dictatorial central government power systems. They need strong government, I dare say, at least until democracy can get off the ground and become understood. The concept of responsible opposition and what have you needs to be understood and developed. But I think they will work it out for themselves, and I believe firmly that only the Iraqis understand and know what they need and what they want. And the people there are desperate for peace, for security, for, I think, representation, but more importantly, probably for most, they're anxious for health care, for education, for employment, for housing, for all the things that we in this country expect and most of us obtain, although of course we have our own problems here and in Europe and elsewhere.
Well, your comments bring up another issue that I often hear that's raised by people, you know, who are against the United States pulling out, and that's in terms of talking about democracy. There are some who argue that, you know, the Iraqis don't understand the whole concept of democracy, and, you know, what would a legitimate Iraqi government even look like if we left and didn't guide them through this. Do you think there's any truth to those contentions?
I think that's pretty arrogant. I think intellectually many Iraqis understand democracy, but as I said, they have no experience of it. And many would look at the United States and question whether this is a democracy. When you have the Patriot Act and some of the other arrangements in place today, you know, it does raise huge questions overseas. So this may not be the model. There is no perfect model. But, you know, the continuing presence of military forces and the aggression that's ongoing and the loss of life, I think the United States has now managed to alienate 80-90% of the Iraqi people. The damage they've seen in Fallujah and Mosul and elsewhere, and the arrogance of an occupying force is just something that the Iraqis, who are an extremely independent, dignified, and proud people, arrogant themselves, I think would be correct to say, must be given the chance to run this country themselves. Now, the problem is, we know Mr. Bush has ambitions for strategic location in Iraq. We know he's in the process of building 10 or 12 military bases in Iraq. We know he's concerned about energy and oil supplies for this country, and control of oil is obviously going to be a huge factor in any decisions made in Washington. But, you know, given the Vietnam experience, when you're left handling a Fallujah-type situation, I think you have to acknowledge the war, per se, is lost, and the best way to get out now would be to give the country back to the Iraqis and be available with capital inputs, with technical assistance, whatever else they, the Iraqi people, think is desirable, is necessary. I think that's the way to turn it around, to turn it into a friend as opposed to an occupying force, and with the rest of us worldwide, be available to Iraq as they need assistance in the years ahead.
I guess I have one more question that relates to you know, the myriad myths, lies, and half-truths that have been set forth really all through the whole sanctions era, and they continue to be today from, you know, now the Bush administration. And that is, they often argue that that the UN is not the the organization to handle bringing Iraq to a peaceful condition and helping them to, you know, institute democracy and so on. Even to the extent that, you know, they, officials will often say that the UN is just ineffective. As a former Assistant Secretary General of the UN, how would you respond to those sort of allegations about the UN, and particularly in the context of what the UN can do to help Iraq?
Well, clearly, in the political arena, in the area of peace and security, we've all had deep frustrations with the United Nations and the Security Council. We know they've failed repeatedly, whether it's Timor or Rwanda or many other examples we could discuss. The fact is, the United Nations is run by the member states. It's not run by the Secretariat. It's not run by the Secretary General. The decisions are made by the member states. And at the moment, particularly dominant is the United States itself. So we have to remember, the UN will only be as good as the member states allow it to be. It'll only be as good as the respect for international law is on the part of member states. And this is one of the problems many of us have with the United States, because as we all know, the U.S. is not signing on to Kyoto or the International Criminal Court or the Rights of the Child or conventions with regard to chemical weapons or even nuclear weapons. So we have a huge problem here. When the largest country on earth doesn't follow the rules, how can we look at others and expect compliance? So we have a fundamental problem here with the Security Council. Now, if we could change some of that, and I think we can, and that there is a reform movement, you know, there's a report on paper already towards change, I think we can see a more viable United Nations, which would have the possibility to respond more effectively, would respond perhaps before calamities happen, i.e., say, get into Rwanda before genocide takes place. The secret is that it has to be done even-handedly. We can't have one standard for Iraq, a different standard for Israel. We have to deal with every country in the same way and look at occupation or look at invasion and treat them in the same manner. And that means compromise on the part of, say, Washington vis-a-vis its allies and friends. Everybody has to be treated in the same way, North Korea, Iran, whatever. It's a tall order, and it's naive, perhaps, of me to even suggest this can happen. But if it doesn't happen, I think we've lost the United Nations and its value, and those who say it's now nothing more than a talking shop will be proven to be right, and that would be a calamity, because I think without it, as many have said, we would have to reinvent it, and that's really not necessary in my view. It's a pointless exercise.
Now, you mentioned that there's a sort of reform program underway within the UN. Is that focused primarily on the Security Council, the structure of the Security Council? And if so, what specifically are the reformers trying to do?
Yes, it is primarily focused on the Security Council and its expansion. And the expansion is intended to make it a more representative body, particularly given it has the key responsibility for peace and security around the world. And the plan is to increase the number of permanent seats, permanent members, to, I believe, 11, and then have an additional number of two-year appointments, making up a council of 24 as opposed to a council of 15 today. The way it's being done, I don't actually endorse. I think we already have a permanent membership that looks like OECD countries, except for China, which, of course, is nevertheless growing at an extraordinary and successful rate. To add Germany, Japan to that, to me, makes no sense. I believe France and Britain should be dropped and one permanent seat be given to Europe. And then we must look at South America, for example. One seat, I think, should be allocated to South America. And it's up to the member states of South America to determine, is it going to be Brazil or Argentina? And I would suggest we could rotate the seat, so to speak, between the countries of the region as decided by the region. And that would apply also then to the Middle East and North Africa, to Sub-Saharan Africa, to South Asia, to Southeast Asia. Under that format, that geographical format, every country, in theory, would have some access through its sort of representative permanent member. You'd have to have local regional committees of some sort to make sure that the needs of the region were represented around the table. But I think you could have a very different and somewhat more democratic Security Council in what is the most important area for the well-being of all of us. If we want to deal with poverty or terrorism or whatever else our concern is, without peace and security, you know, it's not going to happen. And therefore, a new council that really works and isn't dominated by five members who happened to win the Second World War, you know, it's time for change and it's time for democracy.
For listeners who maybe aren't as familiar with the structure of the United Nations and the Security Council, can you just describe, you know, what is a permanent member, who are they right now, and how does that affect their power within the broader body of the UN?
Organizationally speaking, the United Nations, the organizational structure is a straight line. You have on one line the Security Council, the General Assembly, the International Court of Justice. You have the Trusteeship Council, Economic and Social Council, and so on. It's a very strange organization. There's no supreme entity like, say, the Supreme Court, who provides oversight and decision-making when such is required. The Council is the most powerful in recent years, although it's not representative. The General Assembly itself has 191 members. The Council has 15. And those five permanent members who have veto power are essentially the victors of the Second World War. That is, the United States, Britain, France, China, and what used to be the USSR is now Russia. It's a very outdated concept, the veto concept, and the membership needs to be expanded, and I think it can be done. I just don't think the way it's been done now is correct. Who are we? Who is this panel? Who is the Security Council to designate Japan, Egypt, Nigeria, or South Africa? I think those decisions need to be made within the regions concerned.
With a structure like that, you've got the five countries you mentioned as the permanent members of the Security Council, the members who really have with the veto power a significant jump on things in effect compared to the other countries on the council. Doesn't that certainly leave open the possibility if one of those victors, as you said, from World War II, becomes significantly more powerful than the others who are permanent members, doesn't that leave the Security Council itself open to significant abuse from that power, and do you think that's what's happening today?
Well, I think that's exactly what has happened today. We don't have a balance. We have a one superpower world situation, and I think Washington's frustration was very evident in 2001 and 2002, leading to Mr. Bush's decision to bypass the Security Council and take a preemptive and illegal invasion of Iraq, which has no resolution of the Security Council to support it. That is, in my view, short-sighted, because already we now know that Washington understands that even Iraq, which is not a large place, was not well-armed, had no serious military capacity, cannot, in fact, be managed by the United States, even with Britain and a few other friends and allies. It's a much bigger problem than perhaps Mr. Bush understood. And now, who's coming to the United Nations looking for support and assistance? Washington. So I think the U.S. has learned a lesson in a very short space of time that the U.N. is in fact useful. It is needed. The U.S., even with all of its military power, cannot go it alone, cannot be the world policeman. So I think we've had a lesson very quickly, and there are many other areas where the U.N. serves the United States, whether it's environmental issues or aviation or standards regarding to proliferation of nuclear weapons or chemical weapons or all of these essential things we sort of forget about and take for granted. Every day, the UN does extraordinary work, whether it's UNICEF, whether it's human rights, or whether it's refugees. These are ongoing every day of the week, and we don't focus on that. And the U.S. is a participant, an important participant, a funder of some of these activities, but the U.S. also needs the protection that these activities provide for the United States. So it's a two-way street, and I think many in Washington are beginning to understand that better and are beginning to understand that U.S. respect for international law is important, and that although the Constitution is the first responsibility, I guess, of Congress people, international law is something that is actually wider and bigger, and adjustments are going to have to be made.
Well, in sticking with the theme for just a minute, for the U.S. contempt for international law, George W. Bush mentioned, I think, in each of the debates with John Kerry, in the run-up to the election, that he's against the International Criminal Court. And he didn't say why, and Kerry didn't call him on it. And but particularly for someone as well-versed in the international legal scene as you are, what's your opinion about that? Why is George W. Bush and his administration running as fast as they can from the International Criminal Court?
Well, I think what he has said is that he believes that the court would be politicized and that Americans, and American military in particular, would be somehow dealt with prejudice and would be penalized improperly and unfairly. Now, the fact is, the court is only used, the prosecution by the ICC is only called upon when a domestic legal procedure is not undertaken. So, for example, when we have problems with Abu Ghraib in Iraq, and we have torture and abuse, and there is some action taken, that would seem to say, well, then the ICC would not be necessary. Now, if the prosecutor of the ICC determined that this endeavor in regard to Abu Ghraib was inadequate, then, of course, he would want to prosecute the military people involved, or their generals or leaders in Washington who may have been involved in the abuse and torture. So, I mean, it's not a danger per se. In other words, if a member state handles its own prosecution of war criminals or others who breach international law, then there's no difficulty. It's only when a country fails to respond, as, for example, we did in this country vis-a-vis My Lai, which that massacre in Vietnam, where I think one individual was given a suspended sentence of 1 year or whatever. That may well is a sort of example, I think, which may turn out to call for international prosecution under ICC. So there is that danger, perhaps, but as I said, if domestic law is properly applied, no member state needs to feel threatened by the ICC.
And finally, I'm going to end with one of those sort of questions that I'm sure you get a lot in terms of finding a resolution to the whole issue. If it's not reasonable to think that that the U.S. can carry on as it is in Iraq, what would your suggestions be in terms of trying to bring things to a peaceful resolution in Iraq as quickly as possible?
Well, I think a very clear indication that this occupation will end, say, in 6 months, might lead to some viability of having an open election at the end of January and to having an interim government which can then begin the process of the constitution and have a full and proper election. I think it's the end of 2005 or the beginning of 2006. I think setting a target for withdrawal of U.S. occupying forces would be very significant. But that does mean, of course, that then whatever plans Mr. Bush has for military bases, that would have to be worked out with the properly elected government, which would come in after the constitutional discussion takes place and is resolved. So it raises questions. It also, I think, implies that the United States would no longer control Iraqi oil production and sales, which again, you know, in my view, is not a problem, in that Iraq, even under Saddam Hussein, was always prepared to sell its oil to the United States. It's not about availability, it's about control, and control of oil, of course, is terribly important, strategically speaking, for the United States vis-a-vis not just itself, but other member states and other friends and allies, in fact. So it's going to be very difficult to see the occupation terminate in the short run. But, you know, given the loss of life of perhaps over 100,000 Iraqi civilians in the last 18 months, and given the loss of life of young Americans, what do we have now, 1,200 deaths, 10,000 serious injuries, many other thousand brought back through accidents and mental and physical breakdown. This is a terrible price, and a totally unreasonable, unsustainable price to be paid by young Americans, men and women both, who I think don't really know why they're there, and I think most Americans don't really know why they're there either. There's still massive confusion that somehow Baghdad was involved in 9/11, which is clearly not the case. Lives are being thrown away, in my view, sadly, by young Americans and their families and their loved ones, and it just doesn't make any sense for this country, for the administration, for the people of this country, and not even for Iraq, which is so sad. We can see, I think, every day the reaction of the majority now of Iraqis to occupation. So what are we doing there? What is the United States doing there? Maybe some of the goals, there is a certain amount of integrity in the desire for democracy, by all means. But as I said before, let's be on standby. Let's be available in Europe or in the United States to assist the Iraqis. But this will never work, in my view, until they've had the chance to sort it out for themselves, just as we would want to do here in the United States or in Ireland or wherever else we come from. Foreign imposition, foreign dictation, it's not going to work. It hasn't worked in the past. I don't think it's going to work in the future. So let's get out of Iraq. Let's give it back to the people of the country. Let them sort it out for themselves. Let's pray there will not be civil war, and I don't think there will be. Let's pray they can work out their ethnic and religious differences, and I believe they can, as they have in the past. There was none of this friction under the days of the Ba'ath Party. Let them work it out and let them resolve it, and then we will be on standby to assist.
Dennis Halliday, thank you very much for being on Making Waves today.
I'm most appreciative. It's a great opportunity. Thank you very much.
Well, this is a song about something that you might have heard about on community radio or pirate radio, but probably didn't hear about on nationalist public radio. In fact, unless you listen to KDNU, you might even not know the name of the city that the song is about or where it is. If I could sing a song for every bomb that flies, I'd sing each and all the days. If there were to be a verse for every dying child's cries, for every helpless father's gaze. If I could write a love letter for each corpse as it's carried, I'd never still mind. If I had to stop a moment for each one as it's buried, I'd never move again. But the stocks are going up somewhere in America. But I'll sing a song from Basra. If I could shed a tear for every home that bombs destroy, I'd never stop crying. If each broken brick were a heart of a little girl or boy, all the world's children would be sighing. If I could hold each shattered body, each baby stilled at birth, I'd have no time for loneliness. I'd spend all my days embracing the people of this savaged earth, feeling the poisoned wind's caress. And the billionaires are laughing somewhere in America. But I'll sing a song for Basra. Were a woman's shiny eyes, I'd fall in love forever. If each bombed out kindergarten were a factory in disguise, wouldn't that be clever? But bricks are only bricks, and dust is only dust, and death is all around. Each day another missile falls, and sometimes the only thing to trust is the shaking of the ground. And they're loading up the warplanes somewhere in America. But I'll sing a song.
Kathy Kelly is the co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness, which was founded in 1996 to oppose the effects of economic sanctions on Iraqi civilians. Kathy has been to Iraq many times, including during the entire invasion by the United States in March of 2003. Kathy is a three-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee for her work in Iraq.
So Kathy, I know that you're in touch with a lot of people in Iraq by various means still, or at least I think that you are, and I'm wondering if you can talk to us about some of their stories. What is life like for ordinary Iraqis on the ground today?
Well, the other day I was standing at an intersection, a busy intersection in Chicago. It was before sunrise, and we wanted to catch the traffic as they'd be going around the bend onto Lakeshore Drive. And I was holding up a vinyl picture with a beautiful photo of a young woman, Johan, who at age 14 weighed 76 pounds. And shortly after the Shock and Awe campaign, my friend Kathy Breen was at her bedside regularly. And she went to visit the little girl for a fourth time, and Johan had died. And Johan had cancer both before, for the long years of economic sanctions, before the Shock and Awe campaign, and after. It's been very, very difficult for doctors to deliver health care to children, to civilians, to people that are felled by the war. And I was particularly thinking of Johan's brother, Leif, because he writes to me these very charming letters. Hi, how are you? I hope you are okay. I still miss my sister, Johan. I think of her a lot. And how do you respond knowing that with the kinds of policies the United States is following, Leith isn't much more secure, even though he may never go into a hospital, as the roadside explosives and the car bombings and the attacks on mosques and police stations continue. So I think of Leith and the tremendous insecurity amidst which he's growing up, and yet he's willing to keep on finding an internet cafe and sending out messages, beleaguered but friendly messages, to people like me in another land far away, where I never, ever experience anything even vaguely close to the everyday life of people like Leif, and there's so many families that are in a similar situation. We also had a message on our message machine from a friend, Heider, who had come and lived with us for 6 months. And Tom, I know that you probably have spent more time than most in Heider's living room, because when we were in Basra in the summer of 2000, that was the place to go to kind of let your hair down. That was
where
we all felt that we could relax a little bit. It was clear that Heider was doing her very level best not to get tied into the Bas party. And we were lucky. We could just go in without a minder, without accompaniment. And Heider, having been here, taught me so much, because, you know, every time we went into that home, as I recall, everything stopped. People scurried about making sure that we each had a cup of tea, if they could come up with enough money to go and get Pepsis. We'd each have Pepsis. If you tried to, you know, move your Pepsi over to the little kid gazing up at you, they wouldn't dare take it. And we were just the guests, treated as guests of honor, even though we just lived down the street and we'd been there for months. But when Heider came here to visit, it was wonderful. We celebrated it. And we really did do our best to make sure that she got health care, that Mustafa got health care, that Mustafa was enrolled temporarily in a school. This family that had been attacked by a bomb that directly hit their home, which was intended for a fertilizer plant and somehow went egregiously and horribly astray and hit their home. But we would be very intent on staring at our computer screens and answering the phones and putting out our mailings. And in some ways, I wonder, what would it be like for us to slow down, to kind of exhale, relax, focus on guests, have the leisure time to think about what we're doing and where we're going. And so on my mind very, very much during the month of Ramadan was the stark contrast between our Muslim brothers and sisters who have fashioned a way of life wherein for one whole solid month, five times a day, they're on their knees, their foreheads touch the floor, the children watch as the adults pray for peace, visibly, actively, five times a day, where every night the whole family at sunset gathers together and relaxes and shares a meal and has camaraderie. The kids play with one another. They know their cousins well. And then they collect the money that they didn't spend on food, no, even the poorest of families, for a solid month. And they make sure that gets sent to the people who don't even have as much as they do. I mean, there's so much to learn, I think, particularly during the Christmas season, when now people are revving up for an orgy of shopping and consumption, and then, you know, people don't even know that one of their major consumptions throughout the year is weapons, because at least a third to a half of our productivity gets laid right at the doorstep of the Defense Department with its obscene $524 billion budget for next year. So, Tom, you'll remember from your time in Chicago a little girl who lived across the street, Heather, and we all said, if Heather comes in, she did get treated like the guest of honor.
Yeah.
She could use our computers. We probably got about four viruses out of that. But well, Heather's a teenager now, and I asked her, Heather, what are you and your friends saying about the war on terror? What do people say in your school? And she looked at me kind of in all innocence, and she said, oh, well, everybody knows it's those Arabs up on Devon Avenue that are the terrorists. And I felt this sinking sense of loss. You know, how have we lost the opportunity to help other people in our own neighborhoods, my neighbors across the street, to better understand who our Muslim brothers and sisters are? And how do we celebrate the birth of the Prince of Peace in our country when there's such a tremendous divide, not, you know, the clash of civilizations, but between basic curiosity and a kind of numbing lack of awareness?
Well, that sort of brings me to my next question, too. What is Voices in the Wilderness telling people or suggesting to people that we can do here in the United States, things that you know, can hopefully help the situation in general?
You know, if you'd asked me this question a year ago, Tom, I would have hesitated about saying that the United States must get out of Iraq as soon as possible. I was still thinking, well, there's got to be some kind of protective presence, and it would take time, and thinking about financial institutions and reconstruction projects. But at this point, I think it's incumbent on people all throughout the United States who would like to see an end to warfare to say that the United States has got to issue an immediate timetable for withdrawal of all troops, shutting down those four major military bases and each of what I think are 13 smaller ones. You know, 2 years ago, nobody was saying, gee, I'd feel a lot more secure if we had four major bases in Iraq. Let those bases go. I think the United States has to acknowledge to the world community we made a terrible mistake and ask countries that were not part of the coalition that attacked Iraq and began the occupation and continues it, ask those countries under the auspices of the United Nations or the European community to try to fashion some kind of a protective presence, yes, but the United States has got to get out of Iraq, bring the U.S. troops home, stop putting those young people's lives on the line, forcing them to go into situations where they can be ambushed and killed, and stop creating a situation where I believe we're, as a professor out on the West Coast said, we're creating terrorists faster than we can kill them. Now, how do we say that? How do we put that message forth? It's not easy. I think it requires daily activity, planning the large actions, grassroots, local actions, going to visit the Congress people, staying abreast of the news and the updates. And I know I'm laying out a menu that's exhausting. But, you know, when I think of people who stand at the middle of the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C., and I know many of them think, gee, if we got engaged sooner, might one half of those names not be listed on that war memorial. When I think of the 2 million Vietnamese who died in the course of that tragic and devastating and abysmally useless war, I wonder, is it possible to avoid a moral imperative to stop this war? Now, the other thing that comes to my mind very painfully but unavoidably is that the Bush administration, claiming a mandate to continue its policies, really doesn't want anything from most of us who aren't of military recruitment age other than our consent and our money. They don't even care about our consent. Basically, they want our money. And that's the one thing we do have control over. So I'm saying to people now, if there's any way that you can find a means to engage in non-payment of federal income tax, in war tax refusal, I think that's a moral imperative right now. We're not talking about Germany in 1939. If somebody refuses to cooperate, to give the Bush administration the one thing it wants from us, you're not going to find yourself in a concentration camp. You're not going to be beheaded. It'll mean a change in lifestyle, but I think that's good for us. You know, we need to learn how to cut back on our consumption, to live more simply, to live with less, to share our resources, to find ways to advocate nonviolence. I think that's terribly important. I think in local neighborhoods, many people can probably walk to the nearest recruitment station, can probably just take a six-block walk and be at a high school that's at risk of being turned into not just a military recruitment place, but possibly a military school. Go to those places and help to connect with the parents there, with the students there, and develop campaigns to say, we don't want our youth to be recruited into the military. We don't want them to be lured into believing that policies based on intimidation and threat and using our young people to kill and be killed are the only way forward. I think it's also important to look at the healthcare issues here. I'm so impressed by a group of healthcare professionals in Chicago who are beginning December 10th on Human Rights Day going to start a vigil at as many hospitals as they can generate awareness in, wherein the healthcare professionals with their white coats and their stethoscopes will be standing outside, doctors and nurses and x-ray technicians, and saying, we have a public healthcare crisis here. We can't deliver adequate healthcare. And it's not because the resources aren't available. It's because those resources are being directed toward attacks that have shattered the healthcare system and delivery within Iraq, within Afghanistan, attacks that have created burgeoning, spiraling crises. It's hard to list them all within the population of Iraq and within the soldiers who are being sent over there now, 12,000 or more. And we'll come back here, many of them maimed, disfigured, psychologically distraught. So we need to be finding ways to tell the truth visibly and in a compelling way here in our own cities. It's a good idea to be in touch with a group like the Italian non-governmental organization, Emergency. Gino Strada, who is the director of that group, has developed clinics in Afghanistan and in Iraq and in Sierra Leone and in the Sudan. And particularly in the north of Iraq, they've got clinics for people who've survived landmine explosions. And they claim that if a healthcare professional goes over there and works for them for 3 to 6 months, they'll never be able to support war again after they've seen the bodies torn apart by these horrible bombs, and will come back to their countries and alert people to where the weapons are being created and where the weapons are part of a profit structure here. So I think, you know, it's good to make sure that Gino Strada gets a full hearing when he comes to the United States in March of 2005. Voices would be glad to help people coordinate speaking engagements for him. He'll be speaking here in Chicago. We've got him first, March 1st to 4th. But to give a good hearing to those kinds of people whose voices need to be heard, not just the generals who stand up to the podium in Qatar and other places and talk about the casualty rates as though this is to be acceptable because, after all, we're at war.
Right now, there's particularly within, you know, if you want to call it the broader activist community, there's a sort of sense of disappointment with the results of the election and so on. And I'm hearing a question that I would love to hear a response from you about this. And the question is, how do you keep going when you're dealing against, you know, the military, industrial, media, congressional, add your own, you know, other words to that complex? How do you keep on going in the face of these disappointments?
You know, I think it makes certainly crucial sense for all of us to sit back and evaluate and ask ourselves, where are we at right now? The activist community in the United States has made incredible accomplishments and gains, and I think those need to be evaluated and not forgotten. The New York Times referred to the world's only other superpower, public opinion, in the lead-up to the war. I think over 7,800 people had been arrested protesting that war. People filled the streets. They filled Lakeshore Drive here in Chicago and shut it down. Internationally, I think public opinion came closer than ever before to stopping a war before it started. So I don't think we should lose sight of that. We were out-manipulated. We were out-orchestrated. We were outspent. Those are all realities we have to deal with. And I think, again, I want to refer to that moral imperative, that if you are yearning for peace, don't pay for war. But I think one of the things that we've not been as adept at is in linking together our grassroots communities. In other words, connecting the dots as best we can. I mean, I feel very good this morning because a young woman is using our fax machine as I speak to put out information about an event tonight that commemorates the horrible industrial accident in Bhopal, India, when Union Carbide's plant blew up. And they've sold that plant now to the Dow Chemical Company, and these youngsters are saying, look, Dow Chemical Company still has a responsibility in that regard to the people in India, in Bhopal, and around the world. And that was one of the instances when a terrible weapon of mass destruction affected civilian lives in a horrible way. But we have to always connect, make our resources available, go to other people's events. And I know, you know, it may sound as though I'm laying out an agenda that makes it impossible for people, but I'm convinced that on an everyday basis within our own communities, we can still do a great deal more to link together. Voices in the Wilderness has on its website a statement called Counterterror Build Justice, Counterterror : Build Justice. While the Bush administration is pounding us with how supportive we must be to them, otherwise we're practically treasonous in their war against terror, I think if we sit back and ask ourselves who really is countering the potential for terrorist acts in our world, it's the people who are working on the sweatshop issue, working on the anti-globalization issue, working on the free trade agreements issue, trying to establish just and fair relationships between people who actually do much more to counter terrorism because they recognize the grievances other people have and they're trying to do something about it. So I think to be assertive and to join together on joint statements, and then in this instance with regard to the counter-terror bill justice, commit, pledge to one action in the spring of 2005 during a month when the UK, the US, and the Canadian militaries will be doing joint exercises for what they feel that they're going to do to counter terror, preparing for a terrorist attack. We should be preemptive. We should do what we can to prevent such a thing, but then to say to our neighbors, to the people who are beyond the choir, look, you know, we are all about the business of trying to make a safer and a more secure